Thanks, guys. And Guy. And most people don't know that Guy used to be a radio disc jockey. Which I can't replicate or match.
We'll turn up the bass, Raj.
Yeah, there you go. That's fake it out with signal processing. So speaking of signal processing, we're here today to talk about digital watermarking. I've been in this content protection business for many years at several different companies, and of late I've been advising the Digital Watermarking Alliance, as Guy mentioned, booth back there. Please do talk to us about what kind of technologies are available to solve some of these piracy problems. But we're going to jump right into this presentation. For those of you that are not familiar with forensic watermarking, it's become a much more sort of detailed requirement for UHD and from the studios. And we're here to talk about sort of how the members of the Digital Watermarking Alliance can help get you guys to actually implement, get the industry to implement watermarking systems that are effective, that can actually deter piracy. So let's jump right into it. And okay. So despite what you might hear in the press, even though we have a lot of really cool, over-the-top services that are delivering really, really great content, the reality is that globally, piracy is actually increasing at an alarming clip. We used to be able to measure it when it was all sort of mostly done on BitTorrent. We used to be able to measure exactly how much piracy was taking place. And today, with streaming cyber lockers and download cyber lockers and other types of piracy that are happening, it's very, very hard to even measure how much of piracy is impacting the business. And that's the part where we're kind of flying blind. And where we sit today in the market, and this is something that I've kind of talked about before, and I'll keep talking about this, because as we get to higher fidelity content like UHD and release windows that are shrinking, and you know, going to day and date types of scenarios for delivering content globally, the reality is that the pirates, the people that actually make money off of this unauthorized distribution, find it really, really easy to steal the signal through many, many means that are available openly in the market, to find the flaws in the conditional access and the DRM systems, or not necessarily the flaws, but the openings that they have, just like any good hacker might, and steal the content and then make money off of it, providing an alternative to folks that may not have the money or the inclination to pay for, you know, authorized use. And of course, there are many people that talk about how, in fact, if you gave legitimate content at a low enough price, people would stop pirating. Well, that is proven to be not the case in all markets, and it is a scourge. I use that word. It's a scourge that keeps growing. And there's some data that actually between 2014 and 2017, the number of Google takedown notices that were related to content piracy went up by 5x. That should give you an indication that the number of searches that are going on and the pages that are available just in Google, this is not sort of in the dark web, this is in Google, has gone up by 5x. And recently, Erdetto did a survey that talked about that, and this is through people that actually self-reported in the survey. 52% of global consumers watched some pirate content within like the last month. So these are data that are available today, and my point is that even though the press kind of, I think, takes a slightly jaded view of this. The reality is that content piracy is going up, not down. And now we have a new thing. In the old days, it was BitTorrent, P2P piracy. It was, you know, cyber lockers. And now we have these little boxes called Kodi boxes. I don't know if you're familiar with them. It's basically a set-top box that can be programmed to go in and sort of find the content, bring it to you, and basically present it just like legitimate content as channels. So there are still many challenges to overcome, and what we're finding, and as the Digital Watermarking Alliance, what we're finding is that this notion of forensic watermarking is, at least technologically, one of the last proven methods that we can actually try to enable the detection of where that content left the authorized media path and be able to find out who actually did it and then take some remedial action to deter the piracy. So I'm going to go through a very quick introduction to digital watermarking for those of you that may not be familiar with it. Oops. And what it is basically, it's been around for many years. It's a signal processing technique that has been perfected over the last almost 25 to 30 years, whereby a signal is put into video or audio, and it survives all kinds of attacks being compression attacks, digital to analog attacks, etc. And there's a whole bunch of literature available, so I don't want to sort of belabor the point, but the main purpose of watermarking is to enable you to have a forensic trail. I used to, in the early days when I used to be at Digimark, I used to kind of use the example of sort of having a LoJack in your content. You've got something in there that travels with the content once it gets outside the authorized usage path, and then you can find it, you can determine sort of where the leak occurred, so that you can then take some remedial action to figure out what are the security breaches that you need to change. And it may be policy, it may be better physical security, it may be whatever remedial action you need to take in your organization or outside of it to be able to say, here's where the leak occurred, let me figure out a way to stop it. So I want to make one point, though, is that digital watermarking is not a visible overlay. It's watermarking, as I'm speaking of it, is a branch of steganography where you're actually hiding the data in plain sight. So what you require is to put the signal in such a way that it becomes part, that you put the extra signal, it becomes part of the actual video, and it survives in such a way that you can detect it even if you were to make, for example, a camcorder copy of. So digital watermarks need to be robust, but at the same time, they need to not deter the quality of the original video. So you don't want it to be so robust that it messes up the signal itself, the video signal itself, but you don't want it to be weak so that it doesn't survive subsequent attacks, whether they be compression or digital to analog and back. So the idea is that the watermark should be strong enough to survive the normal types of transformations that one would make in the process of consuming a video, taking it out of the media path, and then reconsuming it. Does that make sort of sense from a piracy standpoint? And by the way, if any of you have any questions, please raise your hand and I'll be happy to address it on the fly. Oops. Okay, so this gets into a little bit of little technology, but I think it's important to have this discussion. There are generally three types of watermarking technology buckets. And I'm not going to get into the detail of how the signal processing techniques work, but suffice it to say that we can do watermarking in the baseband domain, we do it in the compressed domain, or you do it in the bitstream. There are some differences between how those three things happen. And there are different use cases where it's appropriate. So these different technologies, and by the way, the members of the Digital Watermarking Alliance have systems that fall into those three buckets, okay? So I'm going to go into it very briefly, and if there are questions, please raise your hand. So the first bucket is where you're doing baseband, you're doing your watermarking in the baseband video. It's essentially uncompressed content. So you take the baseband video and you're inserting the signal in the baseband. Okay. The second one requires a two-stage process where you're doing some pre-processing and then you're embedding the watermark with some sort of a manifest that goes with the compressed file, and you're doing it on the client side. The third technique is similar to the second one, but the third technique is that there is really no decode required at all, okay? And as I said, there are different solutions that are available that fit various different use cases. And the use cases I've defined over there are sort of pre-release, post-production, you know, B2B. Then there are, you know, full-length screeners. Then we have, you know, use cases for digital cinema. And then the last category is these B2C use cases where you're actually using watermarking in a, in pay TV, for example, or over the top, where you're watermarking the signal at the set-top box, as an example. So that if somebody were to steal the signal from the set-top box, from the legitimate source, you know, by breaking the, using some way to mux the signal and get it out of the set-top box and cracking, you know, HDCP or whatever, you would then know that it came from that set-top box with that MAC address. So again, there are, in all of these techniques, there are trade-offs related to how you access the actual signal, whether you have access to the raw file or compressed to the bitstream. There are trade-offs related to how much compute power you need and how difficult the integration is with your rest of your workflows. And there are, you know, trade-offs related to, you know, if it's a live workflow, you may have issues with how long it takes to decode or partially decode and then re-encode. So there are some dependencies in terms of how these watermark techniques are applied, and there are costs and latency and computational issues that need to be taken into account when you're figuring out which watermark technology to use. And most of the guys that are in our that have watermarking systems that are represented here at NAB will be able to sort of explain what these trade-offs are. Because really, at the end of the day, it's a signal processing technique, watermarking is, that actually enables you to work through these various trade-offs. And in fact, the next slide is about that. There are design choices and optimization choices that need to be made with respect to how you deploy a watermark system. So there are issues related to perceptibility. As I was mentioning earlier, you want the watermark to be strong, but you don't want the signal of the watermark to be that strong. Actually, it's the noise. You're inserting noise into the signal. So you don't want the noise to be that strong that it makes the human experience of watching or hearing, it shouldn't impede that process, okay? And then there's usually a big trade-off and a design choice related to robustness. How robust do you really need this watermark to be? If you're starting with UHD, do you want to be able to come down to a, you know, really tiny, mobile device down to, you know, mobile device, at, you know, 640 by 480. The answer is, if you want it to be that strong, it's going to have a huge impact on your computational capabilities that are required if you don't want the perceptibility to be affected. So there are these types of trade-offs that have to happen in your design process when you're thinking through how you want to implement the watermark. So there are, I've listed these out, and they will, this will be, the presentation will be on the website if you want to go and download it. I don't want to go into each one, but the bottom line is that as we look at how to make this an impactful decision, the decision to buy one watermark system versus the other, you have to go through a whole bunch of different checklists to figure out which system to work with. And it depends on your workflow and your requirements and your overall system. And you know, there are also sort of trade-offs related to whether how quickly you might want to detect something. So for example, if it was a live case for sports, let me give you a real legitimate example. So today, sports piracy is really, really a big problem in Europe. Soccer piracy, football piracy. So the game is going on, and it's usually a pay-per-view game, and you have these guys that will take the signal right out of the set-top box and put it up on these websites. Okay? So now the game's going on. It's, you know, 2 hours, 2.5 hours, whatever it is. And you've got one guy stealing the signal, and it's on 15 different websites. So today, how they solve it is sending notices to those 15 websites, and it's like a whack-a-mole game. Not effective at all. Take one website down, the next one comes up in seconds. And it's just the guys that do these pirate systems know exactly that's what's going to happen, and then they'll transfer it to another URL that'll redirect. So what we've been thinking about is, how do you turn around and stop the supply? How do you make that guy's set-top box go dark, the guy that's originating the bad signal? In order to do that, you have to have very fast detection while the game is going on. And you have to have a policy discussion about it so that you can actually effectuate this. I want to make that screen go dark, and we'll argue about why I did it later. Okay. So those experiments are going on, and I think there's a lot more work in the industry to be needed to do. But the reality is that what we are, the impact of this, what we're talking about is in the billions of dollars. This is real money. It's not just a shrinkage issue. It's real money. So we're at that point where, so coming back to this slide, so in that example, the design choice you're making is to have very, very fast detection. So you need to work with a provider that can give you that assurance that within whatever 10 or 15 minutes, you're going to be able to, if you found a bad signal, you'd be able to detect it and then do something about it. You know, take that remedial action that you need to stop and deter the actual bad thing from happening. So this again comes back to this other issue, that in any of these types of technologies, and we've got a whole bunch of providers here at NAB, it's a fairly intricate ecosystem. What ends up happening is that the studio ends up saying, you know, I need this type of a watermark to be embedded for UHD or for HD content. Then some service provider, whether that's the OTT operator or the distributor, has to actually agree to a contract to implement it. Then he talks to his conditional access or DRM vendor and says, okay, I need this. How are you going to help me provide it? And then he has to talk to his encoding guy. Hey, can you at least respect this watermark or make sure that your encoding systems don't think of it as compression noise and remove it? Then you got to have, you know, talk to the guy that's building the set-top box and say, well, you know, I need some of this secure stuff inside of the SoC. By the way, I'm an OTT provider. I got a content delivery network. How am I going to have this stuff embedded at the edge? And then you got to work with an actual monitoring company that can monitor this bad stuff, you know, semantically in the market. And then, of course, there's one of these guys, the core technology guys, that actually delivers the algorithms that are needed to be deployed and integrated into those SoCs and those encoding systems and those CAS and DRM systems. So it requires coordination and collaboration and orchestration among the parties. And in order to get this 360 view, where I've got something embedded, I've monitored it, and now I can detect it to take some remedial action. This year is, I believe, it's going to be a landmark year. Movie Labs published some guidelines in 2014, which enable this to actually become a formal requirement. We know that forensic watermarking is the only way to sort of close out this analog hole that we have. And we know that there are people that are talking today. We know that this is happening. In fact, the UHD forum just came out with a spec that has some additional guidelines about how these watermark systems ought to be looked at, alluding to some of the things that I just talked to in my presentation. And there are solutions available today that can deal with even HEVC and HDR and of course 4K. And so we're still working. There's a lot of more standards and best practices efforts that are underway, but you're going to see more of that as the year goes by. But the UHD forum has done some really good work, and for those of you that are interested, I'd encourage you to go look at the UHD forum and download some of the specs related to forensic watermarking. Quick 2 minutes on the DWA. The DWA, which is the Digital Watermarking Alliance, is just a group of companies that really want to continue to create awareness of this proven technology, and help just policymakers, consumers, everybody to understand that, hey, this isn't some nefarious thing. It's a way for us to continue to provide you with the good content that you've become used to, and what we're not trying to turn around and come after people, etc. It's just a way to make sure that people that are making lots and lots of money from things that they don't own don't do it. So it's a long game. And these companies are all working very hard to educate the market. Here are the names of the folks that are involved. It's a company called Content Armor, based out of France. Irdeto is based out of the Netherlands and has offices all over the U.S. and globally. Mark Enny is a company based in Korea that's done a lot of good innovative work in both audio and video watermarking. MSI, represented here, is a leader in audio watermarking and has some really interesting content delivery technologies for both audio and video. NextGuard is now owned by Nagra. It's been around for a long time and has pretty much the digital cinema systems being used worldwide. Verimatrix is a very innovative company based out of San Diego that's doing great work in the conditional access world, and they have a very nice, robust watermark themselves. So I'd encourage you to talk to all of these guys if you're interested in this whole piracy deterrence market that we've just been talking about. And, there's lots of resources available for you to read about and have conversations about. So, and all of these guys are here. And so now, if there's any questions, I'm open to address them.
Any questions for Raj? We've got a little bit of time. Everybody ever has a comprehensive understanding of watermarking and its implications to the industry and our future? It's a little joke.
No, it's so. I'll just end with a couple of couple of remarks. This technology is here to stay. Just you know, for those of you that it is definitely a requirement, and you're going to continue to see it. If anybody is out there trying to license 4K UHD content, it is a requirement. Coming back to the start of the presentation, think about it like this. If there's pressure in the market to reduce these release windows, and the content's available in really, really high fidelity with HDR and 4K and UHD, it's so easy for a person to go into a hotel room, make the room dark, take a 40-inch screen, put a nice, you know, HDR video camera on a tripod and take that picture, and you've basically got that pirated version 45 days after that movie came out. Or imagine you're watching Game of Thrones in the US and you can't watch it in Bulgaria because the it's not available. It is just so darn easy to do it that this is going to continue, and that's what I meant by the word scourge. It's going to continue, and it's not going away. So what we're going to find is that technologies such as the ones that I've just described are going to continue to be a requirement, and the industry is going to have to figure out ways to implement it. So with that, since there are no questions, I'm available if you want to chat. Thanks very much. I appreciate your interest and your intentional listening to what I have to say. It's important.
Rajan Santani, thank you so much. Thanks, Raj. It's great.